All right, this is the Cool Shit Podcast. Each week, we round up the latest cool shit, helping us think different and keep inspired. What makes it in, what gets left out, and what gets challenged. Is it cool? Is it shit? Or does it cross the magic threshold and come bona fide, certified cool shit? Welcome to the editor's meeting.
Welcome to the Cool Shit Podcast, episode 67. We've been saying it for a while, but now it's actually happening. This is the Next Agenda special. So we have a report for the Next Agenda. We've had a couple out in the last year, and we have a new one that's doing a tour at the moment, but a little bit about that at the end. And it's called Learn to Time Travel. And it's about how cross-generational brands survive, how brands can come into that and do it really badly when you're thinking about cross-generationals, and how some brands just don't do it at all, and how even though some brands are new, they understand that and they understand the cultural touch points that applies to different ages and have a better understanding of how to market in that way.
Do you want to just do a monologue for this podcast?
Oh, James, do you know what? What do you want to pipe down?
That's very good.
Anyway, I'm just going to hand over to Rebecca now.
I thought that was quite good.
It was better, yeah. No, that was a hell of a soliloquy.
Thank you.
The white paper was written by Rebecca, our strategist. So I'm going to hand over to her. Rebecca, tell me a little bit more about how we, first of all, got there. Why were we thinking this would be an interesting subject to talk about and write a report on?
I think one of the reasons we were really interested in looking into this a bit further is over time we've started to see just how much focus there is on Gen Z as being the only audience worth talking to in this world of next generation marketing. And yes, there's lots of buying power. It's really interesting, but it's really important to think about longevity with brands, right? And if you go to one single cohort, you neglect the rest. And we looked into it a lot more, a bit deeper, and they just kind of looked, there are much more opportunities to connect way beyond age. You know, we're moving, things have changed around a lot. We're less tribal, our milestones have moved, so we're not kind of hitting those same beats that we used to. So actually there's a lot more kind of connection points in different parts of life than just thinking, oh, Gen Z are the big things to go to, or millennials are buying this and that. And when you look at how brands track, you know, it's not just one brand buying, one group of people buying into one brand, et cetera. So we wanted to explore that a bit deeper.
It's funny. One of the first reports we wrote was around millennials and how at the time brands were all chasing, you know, each brief was like, we want to speak to millennials, we want to touch millennials. And we were kind of making the point that that is a big swathe of people. You can't just talk about one generation with a catch-all. It's interesting then when you're writing this white paper, because you do a lot of research, don't you? So your hypothesis going into it, did it change? Did it flex? What did you find out when you were talking to people?
We went into it thinking about this idea of trying to reject stereotypes and those aspects of like Gen Z are just chasing brands, or like, can you get to a certain age, you're no longer cool, you can't buy into brands anymore. And that kind of really stuck out to us when we chatted to the Selfie community. It really felt that that was very apparent, and that there was this huge swathe of people, you know, that don't like this binary of just because they're 16 or 25 they dress a certain way, like a certain thing. And at the other end of the scale, you know, the 50 plus were like, well, hang on, I still want to wear the things I want to wear, I want to dress the ways I want to and wear the brands I like, so stop with that. And that kind of really cemented this feeling of, yeah, it's not about a certain cohort, a certain age group owning a brand, and conversely, how brands should only try and market to a single cohort.
I'm interested because I think it's a really, really interesting report. Do you think that this has always been a thing, or do you think we've stepped into that space more and more? What I mean is, and for want of a better word, are we cooler for longer now, or are we more enveloped in culture and have a say for longer? Do you think that's a new phenomenon, or that's something that's always been there, or that's a growing phenomenon?
I'm going new.
I'm going new. I'm saying also, not only does it kind of end later, I think it starts earlier, because I was thinking, you don't see like shit dressed kids anymore now. Like you see like 12-year-olds who are like, because obviously they've got Instagram, they see what other people are wearing, they've got all kind of these cultural examples right there in front of them, that you see 11 and 12-year-olds who are dressed really well, whereas in my year it was the kind of top man Y-neck sort of bootcut jeans and plimsoll sort of thing, which you just don't really get anymore.
Matt, when we were young, 40-year-olds, they looked so fucking old,
yeah,
didn't
like, they totally, right? It's attributable to social media, yeah, and phones. 100%, right? 100%, it's got to be down to that, because you and I, are, well, me in particular, from that kind of generation that, you know, born without them, lived perfectly well without them, and then phones, internet, everything else comes in. So we get the both sides of the coin sort of thing. But we're probably outliers a little bit.
Whereas the industry that we work.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas like pretty much every millennial generation just slightly underneath us is in touch to a greater extent with culture than they ever have been before because they were born on the internet. You know, like your whole sort of awakening of exposure to culture was delivered via the internet, even if it was a bit crap back in the day, whatever, but it was, right? So your access greater, your diversity of stimulus greater, and that access is ongoing, right? And broadening and deepening even now. So if you're 41 now, you're still learning new things, still being exposed to new trends, new cultures, all the rest of it. So it's kind of inevitable that you're going to be more in touch with culture and therefore more of a target for those brands that can manage to leverage whatever their story is, make it relevant to different audiences, and then stretch it out from 16 to 36 to 46 and so on and so forth. So there's plenty of people you probably know outside of our industry, your age, my age, who are like proper nerds, right? Don't get it. Like, you know, real muggles. They don't like, they you know, they're happily walking around in their Ted Baker.
I don't get anything these days. Yeah. I don't understand.
Exactly. That sort of, you know, I'm leaning into my Luddite kind of nature.
Can't say anything these days.
Yeah. And, you know, probably still dressed by their wife, wearing their floral shirt to go out with the three buttons that was in, you know, all of that shit.
I got very specific.
I know, but, yeah. but I kind of recoil, like, whereas there's way less of those people and I look sort of 10 years younger than me. Everyone just seems to be a bit cooler. Everyone just seems to be part of it. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know what? Another thing which is weird, I don't know if this would have always been the case. There seems to be, I don't know if certain kind of elements of culture seems to have more longevity, because to me it seems like there's more of a kind of reverence for nostalgia almost, and there's a lot more rehashed culture. Like I say, for example, and also where it lives on through the internet and stuff, like I'm reading a book about the like 1970s kind of new wave punk movement in Liverpool, and I sort of have a kind of, yeah, reverence for it. But at that time, I doubt they felt like that about things that were happening 30 or 40 years earlier, because you wouldn't, I don't know, you're not going to feel wistful about the Blitz, are you? And think, oh, I wish I was there for that.
Well, plenty of gammons still think they were there for that right now. Yeah. But yeah, I think like nostalgia has become this incredible cycle now because we understand culture a lot more, because we understand trends a lot more. So nostalgia is a thing. And we did a piece a while back for G-Shock about how the target audience we were looking at, time travel. You know, they're kind of looking to what G-Shock can offer them in the future, which is resale value, longevity, because it's the world's toughest watch, a place in kind of contemporary culture if they get their marketing right. But also then to kind of almost check that out and to check G-Shock's creds. You just go online and you look back to Pharrell selling his Baby G collection, LL Cool J being shot with a G-Shock watch in like the late 80s. And you've got this idea of, it's not even nostalgia, it's just this ability to time travel and to mix and match and pick from my various trends that have happened over that time. And I think that's very much sort of with us now. And the brands that we're probably going to talk about can do that really, really well without losing their way. You know, I always, always bang on about Vans. You know, I'm a fan, but Vans worn by old people like me 10 years ago, they were an outlier. It was like sort of someone that probably skated or was probably into music. Like, whereas Vans not worn by someone like my age now, it's just like someone who just has a bit of a very slight kind of outlier status to the rest of his generation, but basically is like just a bit more cultured. Kind of gets a bit of fashion, has an independent look, has whatever else it is. You know, it's like there's something definitely changed in the last 10 years, that when I looked at someone my age 10 years ago, there was no one, or there were very few people who were what I would consider cool. Whereas now you start to look around.
Well, I suppose it's easier to kind of, you get sort of payback and sort of copycat cool as well then, because and then to the point where it potentially becomes uncool, like the Samba, for example, where it just becomes kind of passé and like, well, it gets memed essentially.
It's passé and memed within a certain small band, but I reckon if you're, you know, I don't know, living out in Swindon or something like that, you know, it's still very cool. Like, they're still not stopping. Yeah. They're still bringing more out, you know.
I wonder as well, we were talking earlier on, weren't we, Rebecca, because there's always an obsession with youth, and you think the way culture moves, and you use the example of someone like Billie Eilish, who essentially feels like she's been around for a long time because she's writing music when she's 16. I think she's probably about 21 now. And
no, really?
Yeah, right. Yeah, she's
older than that, isn't she?
No, it's 21.
Sure.
Someone Google it. Billie Eilish is 21 years old.
Right, I'm going to say 24, but...
No, she's not 24. She's
21. Go on, Matt.
I'm on it.
Scores on the doors.
23, I'm going 23.
She just turned 22.
Thank you.
Jesus Christ.
But I think you mentioned Pharrell there, and I wonder as well, the balance of culture has sort of shifted in the way that you get people like Kim Kardashian, who's probably about 43 years old, Pharrell, who's probably like plus 50, and they seem to have a real stake in the way culture is shaped nowadays. So there are totems now that I don't think existed before to other generations, of people that have grown old but still seem really contemporary. Talk to me, Rebecca, about brands that are doing that, because Matt's mentioned Vans there. Do you think that this is something that's available to all brands? Do you think that you've got more of a chance of it if you are a classic brand that has some heritage to fall back onto? Or do you think that brands coming into this space now can do that?
I think brands, we see this most with brands who have that legacy, have that heritage, because they are the ones that the ability to have that constant story where they can hit those beats. They kind of keep that story running through the red thread and update it with partners or with collaborations. And it becomes almost like an anchor that you can return to. And I suppose because we see so much of like social media and got new people popping up, the same people crop up again, all the same brands, because it has that totemic ability to kind of connect back to a stage of cool where there's slightly perhaps less consumption cycle or less kind of trend frenzy. I suppose the other example we linked into in the report, but of course not one that's necessarily a legacy brand, but something, a newer brand doing something interesting, is Aimé Leon d'Or in New York. And the reason we wanted to focus on that one, because it is not a legacy brand, it hasn't got 50, 60, 70 years of cultural heritage. It's, you know, it's been going since like the late 2000s, 2010s. So this is something that what they have done is jump back onto that like 90s nostalgia, that kind of hip hop basketball culture of coolness of New York. So using some of those cues, but they have it in a very contemporary way, have a cool kind of number of collaborations, but they also deliberately target a wide audience as well. It's not just going after the young kids. You know, they are kind of, you know, we've seen their amazing ads with their New Balance collabs, when you've got these amazing kind of chic looking people who are what, 70, 80 plus, because they recognize that it's not just about, okay, that might not be the target audience, but they understand that they're speaking to people who aren't just 16. They're speaking to an older kind of cohort as well, who think that there is a...
You know, that's interesting, because then what you're doing is you're priming young people to aspire to a brand that perhaps they're not ready for that price point, but they're going to move into that brand. And then the people that are slightly older, because I reckon a load of 35 pluses are like using Aimé Leon d'Or, they are probably feeding off the fact that it, in young people's eyes, it's a cool brand, right? So it's got that... that magic thing where there's a, you know, it's working for both of those people in a bilateral manner, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And its ability to kind of, and then even if you're, let's say you're 35 and buying into it, you also think, okay, actually this will be a brand with me that will travel. I probably still want to be wearing it when I'm 40 and 50 because it feels timeless. It's classic, it's contemporary, the tailoring is kind of smart, but it's got those very nuanced streetwear codes, but not in a, oh God, I'm look out of place, so I'm trying to be in a video with a bunch of 16-year-olds from London. You know, it's not trying that. They've got a really interesting marker that has that kind of a quiet-ish luxury, but not going into succession status.
Yeah. James, I'm really old, but people think I'm young. You're really young, but people think you're really old. Is there any examples that you're going to bring so we can like start thinking about how other brands are doing this at the moment?
We've got a few examples. I'll see what might make sense then, because where you were talking about G-Shock, and there's a kind of a demonstration of a kind of the kind of cultural nous, I guess, the sort of longevity. And I think one of the ads that kind of attempts to do that, and probably did it quite well, and it's kind of one of the emerging titans of the kind of Christmas ad bum fights, and arguably sort of the reigning champs, because I know John Lewis got a bit of flack for their one last year. So JD Sports, their Christmas ad just gone. Has everyone seen it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Yeah, so because I know, I feel like, well, I'll say my piece first. I feel like typically they're quite sort of, they're probably to youth culture, whatever John Lewis is to 50-year-old mum culture. But I feel like this year they moved beyond youth culture while still feeling kind of tight and not like culturally flabby between like the casting and the blending of nostalgia in the ad while still feeling kind of progressive and forward thinking. It felt like they kind of expanded the aperture of their potential audience beyond just kind of urban street kids.
I got a point of view on that also, which goes back to this idea that people are cooler for longer, as you say. And one of the things that we've observed is that, and this is cost of living, COVID, various other things, but like more young kids are having to stay at home, obviously living with their parents, but their parents are, from an outlook, more cultural and younger. So you're not cringed out by your parents as much anymore. You know, and we've had from various bits of research that we've done that when you talk to people about who your sort of icon is, and you leave that question open really wide, you know, they could go and say a footballer or a musician or an artist or whatever, right? A humanitarian or something like that. Loads of them say my dad or my mum. We found that out quite a lot, haven't we, over the last sort of few years?
Working with D&G, one of the past campaigns they did that they put families in it, everyone talked about that, fact that that's really cool, seeing like a whole family in an ad.
So that's my point on JD, is the time is right, I think, to do that cross-generational ad, because again, 20 years ago, like, it would have been that kid who comes in and goes, fucking hell, my mum and dad.
My dad looked like Roger the Dodgers' dad.
Exactly, you know? Whereas now, like, the everyone gets it. Everyone's been buying JD for 20, 30 years now, and your dad can still rock a bit of JD Sports and not just look either like a bland, retreating into the bushes Homer Simpson sort of character, or not look like a tragic, like, you know, mutton type of thing. So there's a place for it now.
And it did kind of family community, but without being sort of saccharine and worthy. Like, it felt very kind of, real for one.
And especially at Christmas, right? It is a time that we're all with our family. Now, apparently the ad or the sales didn't reflect.
Yeah,
really?
So did media buy right? Was the actual messaging wrong? What do we reckon to that?
Who knows? But, like, we are in a funny time where people, you know, may not be spending as much money, sort of full stop. But, like, I think the ad, ask anyone, was a success. Do you know what I mean? It was meaningful. It was iconic with the yellow bag and all of that stuff. Some good talent in it, like Kano bang in the middle there, and, you know, there's older people in it.
That's the kind of blending of the old and young, because I think it was Central C as well, wasn't it? And with Kano, that's kind of what I was talking about. It's like, when we're talking about how, like, you can feel... I feel like a lot of people can feel nostalgic for a time when they weren't even alive now. And Kano was sort of, must be like nearly 40.
He's 38, but
okay.
You know.
But it's like the first kind of wave of like sort of iconic grime MCs that most, well, like 20-year-olds literally just weren't around for now, but still have that kind of reverence for. So I think this is a way of kind of JD showing that they get it as well.
I was interviewing someone for Selfer, Jackson, a young guy, for the last Next Agenda paper, and I was talking about Kano, and I was like, do you like Kano? And he's like, oh yeah, I like all the OGs.
Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. And seeing them as, you know, like you're saying, like I don't know, like the older guys in the
crowd. Well, that's what they are. That the old gold. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Actually, I'll tell you the other thing that I thought with this, and because it made me think of something in the paper, which I found really interesting, was this reminiscence bump, which actually, Rebecca, if you don't mind, because you'll probably be able to describe it better than I can. Do you mind?
And so
she does mind.
Yeah.
For the listeners, Rebecca looked out.
So the reminiscence bump is linked to something that it's like a psychological term, and it's essentially this idea that, you know, when we start to form memories and our brains start to kind of create neural links, that sort of those neural links start to form typically around the ages of kind of 8 to 16, I suppose, a bit older.
Yeah, your kind of brain works in these sort of waves of 8-9 years kind of thing, and you're at a particularly open state, as it were, for big emotional connections in that sort of, eight is your kind of developed brain starts to happen right the way up until, you know,
26, 27.
You're sort of mid to late 20s, which is when you start to lose neuroplasticity quite a lot. But more than nostalgia, the reminiscence bump is more about the sort of the positivity and the feelings and the whatever. So forget all of the other cultural stimulus. It's literally you see something and your brain is making these lovely warm serotonin.
That's kind of what I was going to say, because in the ad sort of is using the bag as like a symbol for a period in people's lives when they're at their, well, like you said, kind of most formative and potentially the time that they feel most fondly about. So then by doing that, you've kind of is able to then speak to the people who are potentially looking forward to going through that period or going through that period now or have been through that period 10 years ago.
Do you know the first pair of trainers that I was allowed to buy, like the ones that my mum didn't buy for me, were the Nike Air Air Max 90s. And that colorway, you know, the orange colorway, it's the reminiscence bump. As soon as I see that colorway, it's got an effect on me. If someone's got them on in the room, I can just see it out of the corner of my eye, and it creates a feeling that's not nostalgia, but it's they seem really modern to me still, because they seem very modern at the time, and I associate them with a modernity, which is crazy when you think they're like whatever 30 years old or something.
I have the same when I see Gordon Brown. It's kind of warm inside,
right?
I think it still happens with music as well, and I think my embarrassing admission was, I was getting ready to go out at the weekend and I couldn't really think about what to put on Spotify. So getting ready, first thing that suddenly came to mind was Spice Girls. So there I am getting ready.
If you want to be mellow.
Yeah.
But I think good brands understand how to play into that. Like there's times when you need to pull the nostalgia card, fine. Or even the faux nostalgia. We need a word for that. Is there a faux nostalgia? Whatever, but you know what I mean. And then there's other times when the target audience that you're talking to, for like you primed them, whether you knew it or not, as a brand right back in the day, and then you can kind of bring that back. And I think Amy Leon Dore do that, even though they weren't there back in the day, they pull on a little bit of that reminiscence.
Well, isn't that quite stout, then, isn't it?
Yeah,
a little bit of that, but also that sort
there's
of reminiscence days, of some of the semiotics of it, though, as well, of like, you know, families sat on the stoop in Brooklyn and things like that is like. You know, you kind of have those warm feelings.
Well, that's what I think you can demonstrate a kind of a cultural understanding without having to have been there for the last 70 years.
Yeah, totally. So I think brands that understand when to, you know, if you want to be cross-generational, when to just sort of rely on your truth, your story, the sort of the Vans kind of skater sort of slight outlier of, you know, fashion and culture sort of thing. Brands that kind of may not have been there at the time but can still play the reminiscence bump stuff. And then other brands like, you know, the Adidases of who understand how to balance nostalgia with current trends really, really well.
That potentially leads us on quite nicely if you want to go for another one. See, we've pushed this back, this special episode back so many times that I've been forced to watch this ad a million times. For resale purposes. It's turning the other mind.
So Gina's half the views and the other half are James.
Lit himself on it.
But I think... I
could just say James is wearing a plain white T-shirt right now.
And nothing else.
Tighty whitey.
But we spoke about this a little bit last time. I think this is an example of a brand that kind of does have, well, that heritage has been around forever and is, and in this is kind of embracing, is using a universal idea that's going to work always, but with a kind of very contemporary spin by featuring the sort of the man of the moment kind of thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, like reading the press of our industry, loads of people tried to go, oh, you know, but there's no story to it. It's just a man in pants.
I don't need it.
You don't need it. You've got someone like him in a brand like that, shot the way it was shot, which echoes, you know, when I first engaged with Calvin Klein, it was pants. I couldn't afford like the designer gear, and it was just when they were moving into.
Well, I just think of them as pants. Yeah. I don't even think beyond that. I mean, I wear CK1, whatever, but I still don't even think. I just think pants.
And then jeans. In order for me, it was like pants, then sort of jeans, because they did those like really iconic sort of, you know, cut and color of jeans, and then they were like almost first out the doors with that CK1 as being a perfume for boys and girls, mm-hmm. or a scent for boys and girls. So for me, that hits the reminiscence bump. But they also understand, like, this guy is, like, of the moment, very desirable. Stick him in.
Then the heartback is Marky Mark and Kate Moss that did a similar thing. Yeah. I mean, essentially, it's the same thing. Yeah. It's just good-looking people in their pants. Mm. And it seems...
It worked.
But it's funny as well that because their recent iterations before Jeremy Allen White breaking the internet again, you know, they've run a few campaigns of other celebrities in their underwear. I think, like, Selena Gomez or kind of, I think, a Kendall Jenner. That didn't quite get the same.
Do you know what? But they chose the right person for the right moment. But yeah, right?
It's the right moment.
And that's what's. I feel like TV is a kind of, in general, is a good kind of proxy or example for this idea of kind of what works cross generationally. Because like The Bear is a great example that you can really enjoy that as a 15-year-old or as a 60-year-old. It literally makes no difference, and it's something that like the whole family can watch together as well.
And it's not really good.
Same with like Succession. Like for entertainment in general is probably the best example.
But I also think we demand a little bit more now, right? So Selena Gomez, Kendall Jenner, mega star artists. I would suggest that they don't, their brand is not like serious. They're not serious people. They're not into their craft in the same way that he comes across as a serious guy, serious about his craft. So what you get from that is you get this like beautifully shot campaign about some like great underpants, basically, and someone in it who you kind of go, oh, yeah. Like that guy, like,
of course,
yeah, exactly. You know, and it kind of makes a load of sense. Whereas the others felt a little bit expected, a bit throwaway, great looking people, musicians.
But do you not think, though, that when you are, to your point, right, say that you're high craft, the fact that you're like prancing around in like half naked, it's something becomes more surprising. You consistently see Kendall Jenner in skimpy wear, right? Whereas when you have someone that seems seemingly highbrow that then has that thing of like them like, you know, writhing around in their pants and doing pull-ups, it's like there's a baseness to it where those two things collide and you go, that's interesting.
Exactly. There's there's a complexity in the execution. Daniel Craig doing...
The Von Trier one.
Belvedere.
Was it Great Goose?
Belvedere.
That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Someone who takes himself quite seriously, you know, or that's our perception of him, doing some very unserious things for a quite serious brand. Fucking great. It works really, really well, you know, and it's, again, that's kind of that cross-generational thing works really well.
That's a really good example of cross-generational James Bond, right? Like every single generation has a James Bond, so it's an interesting take on that, right?
Why don't we go back one step? Because we're here to kind of promote our next agenda paper. I don't think we did mention when we were talking about it is the three sort of principles that we put in it about how brands can potentially do what we've been talking about for this. So if we go back to that, we've got story. I think we've probably covered that off with Vans and the like.
Yeah.
We've got stealth, which we'll come to in a second. And then...
got scale.
Scale, which, you know, we mentioned that with Adidas, with Gazelle. We mentioned that, I think that's JD as well. The fact that it stocks these brands, which just, it has something for... now, everyone, right? But let's talk about stealth.
Well, go on then, stealth. Rebecca, what are you saying about stealth? Because there was principles that brands that came at the end of the report to help brands shape the way that they can have the ability to time travel, right?
Yeah, so stealth essentially is, I would say, it's down to the activation or the kind of cultural strategies brands use, particularly to be able to speak to different audiences at the same time without kind of upsetting the heartland or their core. So, you know, this might be when you have a potentially a luxury brand that wants to prime younger audiences but don't want to scare off the people that possibly can buy into their more expensive products. So, for example, you know, you could see that in Defender and how they work with Kano, or how sometimes some of the Defender products, you know, they are massive, big, expensive, beautiful cars, you know, but they're seeding their way into music videos, priming their way into kind of the attention, getting... you know, people kind of hyped up about it. And then when it comes to the barrier to buy is broken down a little bit when they're a little older, that's when they're kind of triggering. I mean, we see that with like Rolex, for example, a classic example. But it tends to be those slightly higher end legacy luxury brands that want to be able to kind of broaden their reach without having to kind of go hell for leather after just one cohort, because they recognise that that's not not a strategy that's going to last.
I feel like my brain has been, and this is a scale example, has been morphed to the point where I think anybody who uses any products other than Apple is a weird person.
Me too. Yeah. Like someone brings out a Samsung and I'm just like, oh, they're you idiot. What are you doing? I completely agree with that. I think that it's a really good example of just a product that is so cross-generational.
Yeah.
It's so ubiquitous. Like, I mean, I don't know how many other people have an iPhone, but it's still something that everyone will aspire to have.
Right? Let me give you another good example. So premium spirits brands, of which we're working on a few of those now, right? And I'll give you a cautionary tale. Jay-Z wanted to drink Cristal champagne. Cristal's chief exec said something kind of unsavory about, you know, that brand and Jay-Z being the kind of musician that he was. So Jay-Z went, right, fuck that. I'm going to basically buy a very small champagne brand and turn it into a powerhouse, Armand de Brignac, because he understands that if you let your brand kind of be more accessible in culture, even people who can't afford it, you might not be able to afford Armand de Brignac yet, but you can be damn sure that every 17 or 18-year-old knows about it and is now desiring it and wants it because he's been talking about it, he's got it, he's bought it, obviously. Whereas, you know, I think brands that don't understand that you can still sell your brand to a certain audience, and that can be your core audience, and that's where your volume comes from. We talk about Moncler quite a lot, you know, about people with lots of money who want to buy Moncler because it does this and that and fucking whatever, right? It's a, you know, it's for posh French people, or it certainly was. They also understood that if I start giving this to stylists, if I start activating through things like Moncler Genius, and they had, I think Rihanna was involved in the last one, you create an object of desire.
Walk through any local estate in London and you'll see like a Moncler jacket.
Yeah, and even if it's a rip-off, right? That's not the point. It doesn't matter. It's about it desirability, that people will either crawl over broken glass to save the money and get it, or, you know, they will buy a knockoff because they want to be part of it, or they will wait until they can afford to buy it. But you've primed them with the sort of desirability. Mercedes do it really well. Mercedes will let their cars be customized by third parties, and most of the sort of major cars do it as well, so they look a bit more kind of pimped, as it were, you know. And you see the footballers driving wide body AMG G63s. Mercedes know full well what's going on there. It's not their target market. It's not even the car that they want to sell most of to make the most money of. They want to sell mainstream cars to mums and dads, right? That's where their volume comes in, and that's where their margins come in. But they know that people are going to buy into that brand as soon as they can by buying probably the cheapest Merc that they can, $27,000 or whatever.
They want the badge.
Yeah. And Merc get it totally. And I think, like, there's a few brands that really understand how to allow or even by actively putting their brand into sort of certain cohorts and certain tiers of culture, that they're priming. They're not. That's
like Fendi sunglasses. Start out with those before you move on to the £1,000 jacket or 100%, something. Yeah,
100%.
And I think you probably get them off of Depop or Vintage or something as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, now we're in a marketplace where that's much easier to do, isn't it? The whole, you know, resale vintage reseller markets it makes that whole thing much, much easier. And brands that, like, don't move with the times and do that, they're gonna just wither and die. 100%.
For one more example, it's definitely kind of story based, and it's probably the most on the nose example of, like, cross-generational appeal that we've got here. So DM's Dr. Martin has released a trio of films featuring all sorts of different faces and perspectives celebrating their connection with the brand. So, like, for example, there's one film which features characters ranging from a 6-year-old pilot to a queer dancer who I believe you've actually spoken to before. For
I interviewed her at Salford, yeah, right. DMs were the shoe to have at my school. Like, you had to have DMs to be cool. It just was the shoe. And I don't know, like, I don't know if they went off my radar, but I've always loved DMs. But it was only about 10 years ago I was just like, do you know what? Everyone loves DMs. Like, it's like they never went away. And I don't know if they did that through variation. I don't know if they did that just by being pervasive in culture and, like, musicians wanting to wear them. But they are a brand that has really been able to last for a substantial period of time.
Yeah, totally. But DMs, like, I like the way they're a bit of a fuck you as well.
And still are. Yeah. Like, they always were and still are.
And
right?
they understand their sort of position. in that respect, you know, of a sort of, again, a bit like Vans, they're just sort of outside of the normies. So if you're wearing DMs, like you've probably got a point of view on something, which I think is, you know, something to lean into. Because like back in, I'm a little bit older than you, back in my day, DMs were just coming out the back of a problematic time because skinheads and National Front were wearing them. And they were called bother boots, you know, because they were, you know, for people who were causing a bit of bother. So whatever happened then, and I wasn't aware of it, I was too young, whatever happened then to get them to they were only a few years younger than me, where everyone wants them, was a hell of a job. And they've done that really well, and then they've kept that momentum up all the way through. Whereas, like, they do highbrow stuff, you know, you can get hundreds of pounds for, like, crafted ones made in a certain way and all the rest of it. They do cultural stuff, loads of good collabs. They do, like, some mad shit with, like, big platform soles and all the rest of it. They're covering all the bases.
I think that's what it is. They're kind of, I guess, identity red thread is sort of what you said, which is having a perspective, whatever that perspective may happen to be, is sort of irrelevant.
They've always been taken by subcultures, but as subcultures have merged, they've managed to retain that sort of like fuck-you-ness of what you're talking about and still stand for a new meaning to subcultures that are more blended, right?
Yeah.
It still represents something of a bit of a spiky decision to put a pair of DMs on.
I love seeing like a 60-odd-year-old like man or woman wearing DMs because you know that like there's something else, there's something more to them, something more fabric.
Yeah, what are they listening to in their headphones? Yeah. You know there's something going on.
Yeah, they're not vanilla, do you know what I mean?
But I like how they still maintain that because I do feel they've such pervasiveness as DMs now that I can see almost every other girl on the street is wearing a pair of DMs, whether it is the boots or it's the sandals. But there is it's so much more accessible, but there is still that core story of, you stand for something. So they haven't lost any of that by still being adopted by more people who aren't necessarily part of those subcultures or necessarily quite so opinionated, shall we say.
That's the thing for me, is like brands who really understand themselves and their position and their relationship and how they can keep that renewing do really, really well. Whereas I think brands that are like keep trying to change or new CMO, whole new brand proposition, you know, just, I don't know, they never get the same sort of depth of emotion and that same kind of, you know, tug on the heartstrings. They might get scale fine through distribution, through ubiquity or whatever, which is okay, but the ones that really kind of connect and create real loyalty just really understand their sort of relationship with people.
And there's a point in the report about kind of brands and not forcing themselves inorganically into culture, and I feel like this is kind of a great example of that. So rather than diverting from what got you to the dance, it's almost like you've got a line there and you rub a little bit out there and add a little bit on the end there and it just keeps on building, but there's that kind of red thread of, well, consistency that goes throughout.
Feels like things move so fast that if you do what you're doing and do it really well, your time will come, and then it's like, what will you do when your time goes? That's then the question, is like, can you maintain, adapt, increase your sort of footprint, DMs, you know, well enough to kind of capitalize. I mean, Clarks are smashing it. I don't know how their sales are, but in terms of their activity and their deepening connections with different communities, it's like
they're really cool now. You see so many like ultra cool people wearing.
I have a pair.
Well, don't ruin it, James.
I've had a pair.
Rebecca, you're on tour at the moment, aren't you? Rebecca's not a musician, by the way. She is holding Next Agenda events, so people can come and get a talk on the report. There is a film that goes a little bit deeper into it, right?
Yeah, so this is where we come together in a bit of a session. We chat about a bit more of the learning, let's dive a bit deeper into what we discovered from our community, hear a bit more about their words as well. It gets really interesting to kind of break down a bit of those generations to not just so binary, find out the move away from some of the stereotypes that I think a lot of media, perhaps brands, start to perpetuate. So we dive into a lot more of that in the report and get a really good chance to get some juicy conversation going.
Props to L'Oreal, Maybelline, Reckitt's, Channel 4. Who else came last time?
It's like a Golden Globe speech.
No, but it's good.
My agent.
There was quite a lot of good discussion from all of those brands that sort of turned up to listen. Yeah, if you're one of those,
if you're a brand owner and you want to know a little bit more about it, your contemporaries
are already learning about it. So you better get in there quick.
Next one is
Tuesday, the 20th of February.
And if people want to go and find the next agenda report, learn to time travel, James, where do they go?
They go to zachagency.com/whitepaper/learn-to-time-travel.
Or just slide into our DM.
That wasn't catchy, was it? Yeah.
Go to the Zach website. You'll find this soon. You'll find it soon enough.
We'll hook you up.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thank you very much. And we'll be back for a normal podcast.
Nothing special about it.
A nothing special podcast soon. Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you very much.